If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. Today, we have another episode in our Everything You Wanted to Know series, where we put your questions to a leading expert. This time, we're speaking about the Black Death with Professor John Hatcher. Putting your questions to John on the medieval plague was our content director, David Musgrove.
Right. Today, I'm joined by John Hatcher, who is Emeritus Professor of Economic and Social History at the University of Cambridge and author of The Black Death, An Intimate History. So today, as always with our Everything You Want to Know podcast, we've asked you, the audience, to submit questions on an interesting topic. And the topic today is the Black Death. So thank you for your questions. And we will jump straight in. So, John, the first question, this is the most popular internet search topic, is when did the Black Death start and end? So can you kick us off with that, please?
Yeah, it's very well known. It started in 1346, and in Mongolia, possibly East China, but certainly in the high steppes region there. And it then went on a massive circuit of the known world, coming south and moving eastwards, so across the Mediterranean, North Africa, and then working its way up. Spain, up into Britain. It comes to England in 1348 in Dorset, spreads to the rest of England and Ireland in 1349, and then up to Scotland late 1349, early 1350. And then it starts moving eastwards back to where it started, so that it's back in Russia and China in 1353. It takes just 7 years to traverse the whole of that really massive arc of the known world. And it's moving at two different paces. There's a much faster movement by the sea routes, and then it enters countries via the seaports by and large, and then proceeds to move much more slowly over land. So it's hitting coastal Italy, coastal Spain, coastal France, And again, with England, it hits at near Bournemouth in Dorset, and then starts moving north across the whole of England in a relentless way. And it spends in an average-sized village 2 months. It's from start to finish, and obviously longer in large cities. And eventually disappears. It ceases in England, for example, in 1349, Scotland a little bit later, and then that's it, although another major epidemic comes back later.
Okay, so that's the basic story there. The Black Death spreads eastwards across Europe and North Africa and has very severe consequences. Do we have another popular internet search question is how many people died? Are we able to make any sort of informed estimate as to the death rate?
Well, people do. The death rate... And that's not the death rate amongst the people who catch it, but in the population as a whole, is between 35 and 50%. And a generally accepted figure for Europe is a population of 80 million. And that means that 30 to 40 million people will have died in the Black Death. If you caught it, you had a two-thirds chance. That's, again, using... the behaviour of plague in the late 19th, 20th century, you have a two-thirds chance of dying if it's left untreated. Nowadays, it's easily cured by antibiotics.
So it's a pretty hideous mortality rate, though, when you consider that.
Yes, I bore people by explaining the difference between... COVID-19, where we're used to seeing statistics not in percentages, but in 100,000 or per million. And once you scale it back, even in the worst hit places, it's 1 in 100 dying from it. When it's Black Death, we're talking about 50 in 100.
So, I mean, that's absolutely terrifying when you look at it in that context.
Yes.
Another popular question, this one we had from one of our readers, Joe Pierce, who asks, how did it get the name Black Death? So it's quite specific to this mid-14th century variant, isn't it?
Yes. The answer is we don't quite know. What we do know is that the Greeks and the Romans, when they're dealing with disastrous diseases, tended to call them black, meaning horrific and terrible. So it's just a negative connotation. And that seems the most likely explanation. But the other explanation, which they needn't be mutually exclusive, is that... bubonic plague actually causes a necrosis in the skin. So if you're infected in under your armpits initially and you have a bubo growing there, as it reaches full term, it'll blacken. And it's the same with the extremities, fingers and toes will start blackening. So it was black in that sense as well. And I think it's 17th century when it's generally called the Black Death. At the time of the plague and in the 14th, 15th centuries, it's the Great Pestilence, the Great Plague, Great Pestilence, and later becomes the Black Death.
Right. So we had quite a few questions that were exploring the question of what actually this pestilence was. And you've mentioned the bubonic plague earlier. Lawrence G. Tilley asked it quite nicely. He said, was it the bubonic plague, a pneumonic variant, or something else? Was it essentially the same as the 1665 Great Plague? Lawrence says he's heard so many contradictory answers on this over the years, and he just wonders where we are with it.
It's absolutely categorically, definitively plague and overwhelmingly bubonic. I can talk a little bit about other variants, but we're here initially bubonic plague, which spreads by a bite from an infected insect. So the normal way it's seen as spreading is being bitten by a rat flea. A black rat will be killed by the disease by the fleas infecting it. The fleas will then come onto a human host and kill them. It's actually a very mechanical process, and about 25 years ago, possibly 30, 40 years ago, people started to have doubts about whether the Black Death was plague. And it was basically, how on earth do you get a death rate as high as that spreading across the whole of Europe with every individual needing to be bitten by an infected flea? And we know from the records at the time that relatively few people died from pneumonic plague or from septicemic plague. They both existed, but they were small. It was basically bubonic plague that was killing them. And how on earth do you get to that level of infections? And for a quarter of a century, the view that started to prevail was it had to be a virus. And there were various fanciful suggestions of the virus that might have caused it. All the way through, I was objecting to this because of contemporary descriptions. The Black Death is a very unusual disease. The swelling of the lymph nodes, the buboes, the process of transmission. So the contemporaries didn't know how it was being caused, but they knew through observing. These were intelligent people, just observed the symptoms in the victims. And it seemed to some of us that it had to be bubonic plague. We're still puzzling about exactly how it would have spread. And increasingly, the view is that in addition to rat fleas, it's human fleas, and particularly, I think, which is one of my favourites in a sense, is lice, head lice, body lice, who have been found to be able to carry the microorganism Yersinia pestis. And I think if you people were full of lice, the clothes were full of lice, they had fleas on them as well. A lot of things must have combined to cause these horrendous death rates. So I think all of these, they're called ectoparasites, carrying it and infecting people. And if you're riddled with lice, your clothes are riddled with lice, you're getting close to spread between human-to-human spread in the way that you see with the virus with droplet infections, people mixing together, sharing clothes, sharing beds that are infested with lice. But that still remains a speculation. It's not at all clear. So there's a lot we don't know about the plague.
So you've just preempted a question by Anne Godden, which was, is it now accepted right. that the vector was human body lice? And you're saying that it's a theory, but we can't say yes or no to it.
It's not accepted. A lot of people object greatly to it. There's somebody who's written a major book on the plague, Benedicto. Oli Benedicto, he's adamant that it was human flea. I've always felt that the lice were able to explain how it spread and the death rates. And I was reading a study this morning just to catch up, and it's a study suggesting through laboratory tests that under certain circumstances, the lice can be very effective carriers of Yersinia pestis. So people are getting infected from the lice they're carrying around with them. But it's still a matter of dispute. And there was a huge EU grant probably 3-4 years ago studying the Black Death, and it's still underway, and the spread of the Black Death, simply to try and explain it with the possibilities of the information that they came up with being useful for future, as we found out with our own pandemic. And it remains a considerable problem. How on earth did that number of people become infected? And we know why they died from it, but it's the rate of infection. And it's really quite remarkable with the English evidence that places of scattered settlement seem to have suffered mortality on pretty similar extent to places of more dense settlement. Towns suffered worse, but if you go up to Northumberland, they've got some good records, Durham and Northumberland. The death rates there are comparable with the death rates in eastern England, which is much more densely settled at the time. So lots of puzzles.
But is there any contention that black rats, ship rats, were involved in the transmission, or is that people are still...
Yes, no, it would be. No, I think the old way of explaining the transmission, black rats and fleas, is certainly still holds up. It's whether that can be the only way. The more one learns, as one does if one's studying it, about the behaviour of rats, they're very territorial. They don't go wandering around. They stay in the perimeter of each house that they're infecting. And so that alone is not possible to explain the scale and spread of it, you know, in my view.
and what you mentioned that the symptoms, as it was described in the documentary references, were very clear. What were the symptoms of Black Death?
Well, it was a general, picking the best one. The trouble with some historians who argue the opposite is that they don't choose the best descriptions. You can find people describing quite inappropriate and incorrect symptoms. But the ones from people who knew, like the papal physician wrote a treatise on the plague very accurately, and it starts with a general malaise, and then it's a spreading, a growth, a swelling in the lymph nodes, the under the neck, in the groin, and that is where the plague itself, the Yersinia pestis, is fighting to overcome the defence mechanisms of the body, and it's concentrated in the lymph nodes. And they give some of the effects that take place later on, which is, spots on the screen, on the skin, and then blackening of the extremities. And there's no other disease that we know about, given the timescale of the death, which is within 3 to 5 days of the first symptoms. Virus doesn't fit anything else, so which is why some of us were holding out for it not to be a virus. But it's the excavation of bones on Black Death burial sites, plague burial sites, and DNA analysis, which has advanced massively in the last 10 years. And they're just finding Yersinia pestis in the victims there. So you can date the cemeteries precisely, and then, which isn't that difficult because they're 10 times larger than they would otherwise have been, with the bodies crammed in. But again, as documentary evidence tells you where the cemeteries are, and then the archaeologists, bio-archaeologists, examine the bones and the teeth, and they're finding Yersinia pestis, which proves it was bubonic plague.
And you mentioned it was like a 3 to 5 day before you passed away. Was it a particularly unpleasant way to die? What sort of records do we get on that? What's the...
People you know, it develops into, you know, with great pain in the lymph nodes, but also splitting headaches. And it says that people rage with the pain and the stories of them. The Italian sources are particularly good, describing people running wild in the streets, you know, throwing their clothes off because they're so, the body's overheating and having to be restrained. So that's a very unpleasant disease.
Mm. Question here from Porcupie17, who says that he or she has heard some people were immune to the Black Death or just never got sick. Are you aware of any evidence to that effect?
Yes. Yep. There were some interesting studies a few years ago where people sort of stepped out, and these are scientists, medical scientists interested in the Black Death, as a lot of them are, and asking the question, why didn't everybody die? Why didn't everybody get it? Well, some of the explanation of that is that they wouldn't have come into close contact with the source of infection. The other explanation is, which seems the most likely one, is that some people have a genetic mutation, which call it that, which means they're immune. They just don't catch it. And there was a very interesting article which said that, why did people survive? And we're all survivors. You know, if you've got a European, North African heritage, we're all survivors of the Black Death. And why are we the survivors? Well, we're survivors. I haven't read anything more recently, but that again was interesting, that some people, for example, TB, some people are immune to TB, very, very unlikely to catch it. So you get diseases which some people are resistant to, and it seems likely that, because once you get up to, if half the people are dying from the Black Death, it means that sort of 70% of them are catching it, of whom 50%, most of them die who catch it. Well, then you're thinking, why doesn't everybody catch it if it's spreading at this rate? And the answer probably lies in natural immunity. Some people. But the other fascinating thing that I didn't think you had a question about it, but it was very interesting, is also related to why it's so difficult to catch the plague now. The disease is virtually identical with the reconstruction of the genome. The Black Death, they've reconstructed it entirely. And far from it being a particularly virulent strain, it's virtually identical to the one that is present today in a number of countries. But it's very difficult to catch now, whereas obviously then. And again, this suggests to the growth of immunity in the population at large, the way some diseases wax and wane, is partly the nature of the disease itself, but it's partly human resistance grows and immunity grows. So.
Let's move on to the question of response. So we talked a bit about what the disease was and what it might have been. Shane Street has asked on Twitter, are there any well-attested examples of towns or villages saving themselves by strict isolation? So a question born a little bit out of current experience, I guess. Was isolation an effective way of preventing the spread of the disease?
Nope. No, there's no example that I know. It's a policy that develops over time of, and there were attempts in Italy in particular, odd attempts in Germany for cities to try to cut themselves off, stop anybody coming into the city. I haven't heard of a village attempting to do this. In fact, it'd be pretty impossible to do. And I certainly haven't come across a case of somewhere that tried that policy, if it was a town. Well, lots of them tried it, and particularly with later plagues, they try it, but with very little success. Isolation and quarantine come by the late 16th, 17th century, particularly in Venice, where they used the islands, but not at this time.
Okay, so that takes us back, I guess, a bit to sort of the means of transmission, how it's spreading, which you've already explained is a little bit of a mystery in some ways. Ian Dawson on Twitter's got a good question, which was, what foods did people think would cure the plague? Did people have any observations on that?
I'm not sure there were recommended foods, except in a negative sense. What there are of foods that you should avoid at all costs, because these would be likely to promote your susceptibility to plague. And one of the most common explanations at the time is that the plague is what they called a miasmic cloud of infection, which was blown hither and thither by the wind, which is why you couldn't keep it out of the town, or why it spread. They obviously, if you'd have explained to somebody in the 14th century, it was actually caused by a tiny microorganism that you couldn't see from a flea, they'd have laughed at you, and probably quite rightly. It was so wild. But this miasmic cloud seems to explain a lot of how it spreads and it's impossible to stop. And they saw the leading physicians saw individuals being infected through the pores of their skin, which again sounds plausible. And therefore they advised against eating hot, spicy foods, or food cooked when it was too hot, having baths, engaging in any major physical activities which would open up your pores and make you more susceptible to catching the plague. But I'm not sure there's that much of a concentration on diet as such. But I think the examples I've come across are things that you shouldn't eat, you know, peppery foods and spicy foods and so on.
Okay, so the preventative measure was to try and keep the pores shut, which presumably wasn't a particularly effective measure. Was there anything by way of treatment that physicians suggested? I.e., once you'd got Black Death, did anyone suggest anything that you could do, or was it basically you're on your own?
There are various attempts amongst surgeons to lance the bubo, which had no effect at all. No, the advice, in fact, it's the same with the church. I can talk a bit about that later. The contemporary physicians, a large number of them said, the best advice I can give you is if the plague's coming to your area, get out, run away as fast and as far as you can. Don't mix with other people. But they weren't explaining why. So you don't get much of an explanation of person-to-person infections. And I think, just to mention, open up an interesting point, is that the ordinary person, of course, most people are farmers, had more idea about the transmission of diseases than the great physicians, because they saw how if an animal had a skin infection, one of your sheep had scab, you kept it away from all the others. Therefore, they had this basic knowledge. They probably, I don't know if it was written down, but if you had a heavy cold, people would steer away from you. So this advice was just common sense. In fact, it's very close to the advice we get now with coronavirus. Wash, but keep distance. don't spend time with lots of people. And so with the, you get this vast academic apparatus of disease, which dates back particularly to Galen in the leading Greek physician, which hangs together very, very well. And therefore, they're attempting to fit the plague into this, and it doesn't fit at all well. Mm. And then you have a parallel knowledge amongst ordinary people from what they've observed around them.
Yeah, yeah. Galen, that's the humours idea.
Yes, yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. And of course, with the plague, the humours would be unbalanced, and eating hot food would provide too much of this. And so that's how they. But it, they obviously weren't going along the right lines. But then I don't think anybody was.
Mm. Mm. You mentioned then sort of the religious aspect to the disease, and Dee Withers has asked on Twitter, how much did people think it was God's work, and how many people thought there was a secular reason for it, even though they didn't know how diseases spread. So I suppose that the question there is, yeah, what was the role of the church in this?
Yeah. Well, in the whole of the Christian and Muslim worlds, an event so great as this and so awful as this had to be God's will. It was beyond definition, really. It wasn't a matter for discussion. Even if they'd have understood how it was spread, it would still have been God's will that was causing it to happen in the first place. So it's then presents the church, and I've studied the Christian church more than the Islamic church on this. It's very interesting how confronted with something on this scale, which clearly has to be God's will, they don't leap in, or the better church leaders and theologians don't leap in immediately explaining why God is doing this. In fact, a large number of them say they're perplexed. It's not for us to explain, because clearly the world around the time of the mid-14th century isn't particularly sinful. They can find all sorts of things. They complain about young women consorting with champions at tournaments, or wearing low-cut dresses, or behaving inappropriately, or various sinful behaviours of people. But there's hardly anybody at the time saying, this is why God's killing you, because you're doing this. So they refer back, as you would, to the plagues in Egypt in the Old Testament. You know, this is what God does from time to time to punish us, to get us to reform ourselves. But, it simply had to be God's will. There must have been some people who didn't believe this, who didn't want to believe it, but this is where the whole of the learning and teaching and beliefs of the time would lead you. And so they pray for forgiveness, then you get in an extreme form the flagellants. There's a marvellous film, The Seventh Seal, Bergman in the 1950s. There's a scene with the flagellants coming into a village, and they welcome the flagellants with open arms, because they're actually flagellating, they're whipping themselves to death to take the sins of the world on their shoulders. So that's the extreme version of it, but people had to become less sinful. And it creates an immense religious intellectual tumult, really, about trying to reconcile things. And I think there is a clear link through with the Reformation. There's no getting away from a religious interpretation at the time. Although I think people in their own minds may have doubted it, but everything is geared up to that. What they're being told, how they're meant to behave.
Our readers and listeners, I know, are fascinated in that the flagellants idea. So that's people going through the streets, you know, whipping themselves to free themselves from sins. So how widespread was that then?
So it fades out. It's very prominent for a time. So you get a number of movements developing or behavioural patterns. One is punishing minorities, believing that they're spreading it. So people believe it's spread by the Jews who poison the wells. The flagellants, it's a very natural extension of atoning for one's sins. And to so some people are praying to God, they're attempting to do good works. Other people are flaying themselves with whips so that God will turn his anger away from the world and things will be right again.
Right, let's move on to a couple of questions about who the Black Death impacted. So Mana Habib asked whether there was a significant class divide regarding those who contracted it, and also wondered about whether it affected men more than women. And then sort of alongside that, Kate Nicholas, who's a school teacher, says that her Year 7 students always want to know whether it affected rich people more than poor people, and specifically whether anyone from the royal family contracted it. So a few questions there that perhaps you could try and tackle in
right.
One.
Yeah, I could start with the royal family. A daughter of Edward III, the reigning monarch, died from the plague. I think she was about 14 and she'd been betrothed to Peter of Castile, one of these family connections, political connections. And she went off to Bordeaux before the plague had hit England and actually caught it in France and died from it, along with a number of her courtiers. But in answer to the question, did the rich suffer more, suffer less? The answer is yes, they did. But it's quite interesting in the longer term. The reason they suffered less, I think, was that they had all particularly, and what the rich people we can measure precisely are the barons and the nobles of England, because their records, if they died, they had to have a record of their death and inheritance passed through the courts. So we know exactly how many of those died. And it's only in the Black Death, it's 22% compared with, say, double that for the population at large. And the reasons for this are, as I say, they could flee in the face of the plague. Ordinary people couldn't. They'd be driven out of whatever village they went to, or they had no means of supporting themselves. So, but it's a realistic thing to do. And in fact, Boccaccio's Decamerons, they flee up into the hills, don't they, the Decameron tales. So that's part of the reason. They also tended to live more in stone dwellings and also have servants who'd be in the kitchens where the rats were and the storerooms. So those factors explain. But interestingly, in the second outbreak, which comes in 1361 and 62, they actually suffer as the same as everybody else, possibly because they haven't been exposed before. It doesn't appear as if it's a disease that favours the rich per se, all those who are well fed. It could be. It's to do with overcrowding to some extent, but health doesn't seem to come into it. It seems to kill people regardless of how fit they are, how wealthy they are, how old they are. There's studies of burial grounds and analysis of the age distribution of victims. And it's not a disease that discriminates in the way that, say, the present coronavirus does, where it's very heavily weighted against the elderly, almost rising vertically once you get beyond about 65. So, yeah, the rich tend to do better, but for reasons not connected with the disease, but just being able to escape and isolate themselves. But they're still hit very hard.
What about that point about the gender divide? Are we able to discern any difference between male and female susceptibility?
Not really. And I'm trying to think now. It seems to hit women and men at the same level. By the 17th century, I'm trying to think if there's been a more up-to-date study. You have what are called the London Bills of Mortality, which are drawn up each time a plague hits the city. And they provide a breakdown of age and sex. And I think at that time, it seems to switch. One plague outbreak would hit women more than men, but not overwhelmingly, sort of 55-45. The next plague might reverse that. So I'm not sure there is a... I'm desperately trying to think of something that's as I did when you I knew about the question. I don't think there is anything that's pointing much in one direction. Yes, there was, or absolutely no, there wasn't. Except all the evidence as a whole suggests that there wasn't a huge difference in the death rates between men and women.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But for all the horror of COVID and the high death rates, we've got the benefit of having explanations for it, of a vaccine being developed, being told how it spreads.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Right, let's move on to how it finished, if we can. So Kat Keary O'Connor, who again is a history teacher, has an excellent question from her Year 7 students who want to know how it went away. So, and she'd love to be able to give them a proper historian's answer. So do we know how the Black Death finished?
No. I mean, she could write a very good research paper if she knew the answers to that. It's very, very puzzling. We know that it goes away, that 1349 is the last case of bubonic plague in England. It doesn't come back. It comes back, as I say, 13 years later, but it just stops. It stays in a village. I've studied a particular village which had excellent records, including a number of manorial courts that overlapped, which enable you to date the plague deaths really with very considerable accuracy. And it just stops. There's a dribble of deaths afterwards, but then it's gone. And we don't really know exactly what is happening. Does it kill all the people who are likely to have been susceptible to it or not? We just don't know. A much bigger, well, an equally large mystery is why this is the second plague pandemic. We're now in the third one. And the first one was Justinian's plague in the 6th century. So the second plague pandemic lasts until the Great Plague of London in 1665, 1666. And in Europe, the Great Plague of Marseille in 1720. But as I'm saying, the Great Plague of London, the Great Plague of Marseille, most explanations, logical explanations of the plague dying out would appear to be the growth of natural immunity in the population, the disease waning in virulence, the black rat disappearing and the brown rats not being as effective a carrier. But then why does it end with the Great Plague of London, which is the worst plague for a century? The plague in Marseille is phenomenal in 1720, and then that's it. It's gone. I don't think there's been an explanation as to why. You can make up all sorts of, well, possible reasons, but it's very, very strange. You'd think the thing would just fade away, wouldn't you? And it doesn't. It ends up with these spectacular events. Very odd.
So sounds like a mystery waiting for an answer. So I'm sorry, Kat, we haven't got the answer for your students there, but perhaps they could work on it and we'll see what we're going to do. We've got quite a few questions which we can sort of conflate a bit about the aftermath of the plague. As you say, it went away. And there's been a lot written about the impact of this huge mortality on society and economy after the fact. So just to take a few questions. So EBC0111 wants to know, what's the link between societal change and the significant decrease in population that followed the Black Death? And then Joshua Rice asked about how the economies of Europe, or just of England, recovered from this huge loss of their population and the consequent loss of trade. And then Palm Plummer wanted to know about the long-term impact on the economy generally. So a few questions there that are broadly asking the same sort of thing, and you're very well placed to offer a view on that, given your job title.
Well, when I was reading history at university, the current view was that the Black Death, yes, it killed a lot of people, but it didn't have that much of an effect. And the explanation for that was that history was a process whereby humans dictated how things would end up. You've got the growth of sociology and analytical explanations of change in society, which were caused by human behavior and human institutions. They determined the outcomes rather than somebody coming along with a great sledgehammer and whacking the world and saying, sort that lot out. We swung back to giving the Black Death and linking that with the later epidemics, the collapse of population, and giving it very considerable weight in the outcome. And it's basically an agrarian population across Europe. A few places like Venice aren't, but overwhelmingly 85% agrarian. The population falls. It leads to more land per head. It leads to a scarcity of labour. And that leads to rising wages for labour, falling rents for land. Land becomes cheaper. And those processes occurring at the heart of society create a major problem for the existing structure of society, with the nobles controlling the land and having a system of serfdom, people being bound to the land. It's incredibly difficult to enforce as a system because the lord of the manor had some soldiers. We didn't have enough soldiers to capture peasants who'd run away to settle on free land elsewhere. So the latest view, and a colleague of mine has just produced a book on it, Mark Bailey, is the decline of serfdom. And it's the undermining of the feudal system by the scarcity of people. In other words, the system was maintained partly by the law and the military power of lords, but much more by the fact that there were too many people around anyway. The 13th, early 14th century population is reaching very high levels, which aren't being reached again until the 18th century. And of course, a much less productive society. So that meant that people wouldn't run away from the land. They stay on the land, and they were controlled by the fact that they didn't want to be evicted and so on. So that's conditioning society. Once that goes, the population is cut by half and the plague keeps coming back and stopping the ability of population to recover. Lords find themselves forced into giving concessions, and you get the system of serfdom has gone effectively early in the 15th century in England. Elsewhere, and you do get in what is now the eastern part of Germany and Poland, a reimposition, a strengthening of serfdom by sheer force. So lords can react in two ways. They can make concessions, be forced to go along with it, because they're still going to be rich. They'll just lose some of their power and authority, but they'll face up to the circumstances. Or they can attempt to impose their will by force. In England, that was never really much of an option, because the distribution of land, each major landholder might have had a sort of base where his power was a bit concentrated. But in fact, they'd have land spread in four or five, six different counties. And this was the deliberate policy of William the Conqueror. He didn't want to set up princes within the kingdom. In Eastern Europe in particular, you have princes holding huge tracts of land. Therefore, it's easier to control the population within those tracts of land than if all you have to do is run down the road to settle on somebody else's land and escape from your lord. So it becomes inevitable. And it leads, obviously, to disputes and discontent, which is why you get the Peasants' Revolt, why you get revolts across Europe. It's a massively unsettling balance of power, with working ordinary people becoming more powerful and being held back by the rules of the time or the richer people who are attempting to keep them in a position of subservience. And this gives rise to the rebellions we see. But it's, you know, in most countries, it's a one-way process. Economic realities rule in the end, and the system declines and collapses. So massive social changes. And in terms of living standards, the The ordinary people are doing much better. They're paying less for their land. They hold more land. They get paid more for the work they do. And that comes at the expense of the landlords and the rich, who have to forego more of their huge share of income. And so it's now seen as a very decisive turning point.
So your answer to the question from Miss Carter, which was, did the lives of survivors improve or get worse, would be that if you're poorer, you got better. But for the rich, perhaps a little bit of the crime. But it's all relative, eh?
Yeah, it's an incredibly unequal society. Mm. So the great landlords suffer in a sense, but people muddle on. So you get rebellions, but even that calms down and people just rub along together. So they end up paying more wages, they end up collecting less rents, but are still rich. So it leads to very substantial changes in society of that sort.
And in England specifically, am I right in thinking that the government of the day did try and preserve the situation with things like statutes of labourers and things like that, didn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is a major factor creating discontent in the Peasants' Revolt. Yes, the statutes of labourers are an attempt to keep wages at the level they were before the Black Death, which is incredibly difficult to do because employers break the statutes all the time. You need a uniformity, and it's what economists call a free rider. If you're somebody who says, yes, this is a great policy, let's keep wages down, but in fact, if I need to, I'll employ people and give the wages necessary to get the harvest in. So you have these conflicts taking place. And also it's an inflationary period in the sense that food prices stay high for quite a while because I think of the general disruption to production. They then start to come down. But the price of goods, of shoes, contemporary chroniclers are complaining all the time. You know, 5 years ago I could buy a good pair of shoes for sixpence. I now have to pay 14 pence and the shoes are nowhere near good enough because people won't work properly. So there's much greater freedom. But the fact that, I'm old enough to remember the way before your time, the prices and incomes policy, where the government actually, in a period of rapid inflation, tried to control wages. And what happened is I think they've faded now, but luncheon vouchers. Suddenly all the firms were giving luncheon vouchers because they could give you the price of a lunch in a ticket that you took to the local restaurant, and it wasn't breaching the statute. There's also a great rash of promotions, so that people who before had been on the bottom rail remained on the bottom rail, but they were given a job title of supervisor or manager. And so everybody was, because the economic realities have to work through, or else you need a really draconian system of dictatorship and imprisonment and so on. And they try it, but it won't work. And the employers are competing against each other. Lords are competing against each other. They're all complaining other people are doing it, but I obey the rules. And so it creates a lot of discontent by trying to enforce it, but in the end it's not successful.
Okay, just a couple more questions to finish up with about today and today's reaction to the Black Death. And a really good, interesting question from Jorn Eichhorn on Twitter, who asks, in what way has the COVID-19 crisis already changed our understanding and assessment of the people's behaviour during the time of Black Death? So we have this pandemic going on. Has it? Do you think that experience has led scholarship in an interesting direction?
It's a bit early to say. I think in my mind, it tells us something about people's behaviour at the time, given the scale of the deaths that they were facing, that in a broad sense, law and order and life didn't continue the same, but human relationships continued in a similar way. So you get uprisings from time to time, but normal everyday life carried on during the plague. And we're suffering a much smaller death rate. And, it's in a sense, it's causing at least as much... Well, no, it isn't, but you know what I mean. It's difficult to explain. I think what you do get at the time amongst the detailed chronicles is the variety of behaviour that people show during the Black Death, that some people became extraordinarily religious and spent all their time praying. Other people locked themselves away. Other people went to the local brothel all the time and drank their money, because if we're going to die, we're going to die. And you see similar sorts of behaviour now, where people are holding parties. They got fed up with it. Other people are obeying every rule. In fact, the general sense I was reading this morning is the lockdowns have got general support. So we complain about them all the time, but there is a majority of people who believe that this is a policy that has to be followed. So I don't know, it'll take a while to see whether there are similarities. But for all the horror of COVID and the high death rates, we've got the benefit of having explanations for it, of a vaccine being developed, being told how it spreads. I mean, people in the Black Death were faced with not only many, many, many times higher death rate, but a lack of explanation of reasons and what's happening. How do we avoid this? What can we do about that? So, it's a good question, but I think it's very early to attempt to draw parallels. Yeah.
Right, last question, a slightly gloomy one to end on in retrospect, but it's from Evie in Year 7 via her teacher, Harriet R. So thank you, Harriet. Lots of school teachers asking questions here, which is interesting because Black Death must be a topic that's taught in school.
It is. It's a Year 7 topic.
And Evie wants to know, could a new strain of the Black Death come back? And from what you're saying earlier, it's kind of still with us, isn't it? But in a controlled sort of way.
Yeah, the strains vary. I think the answer is yes, it could. And there's also the possibility that it could be a variant in the strain which transforms itself back into a ferocious killer of a disease. But it is a disease that's easily cured by antibiotics. You need a fairly early diagnosis, which can be difficult to get because it's a rare disease. When I was in America, I heard of, in California, somebody had caught bubonic plague skinning squirrels, for reasons best known to him. The problem he had was getting anybody to understand what it was. But as long as we know that it's plague, antibiotics cure it, except if it becomes pneumonic plague, where nobody ever recovers from that, which is it spreads like pneumonia. But this is extremely rare. So there could be a new strain. The Black Death, the bubonic plague doesn't seem to change its characteristics all that much. As I was saying, the analysis of the strain in the mid-14th century shows it to be very, very similar to the strain that's currently in Mozambique, occasionally in China, India, and a number of other countries. So it could, but it wouldn't be horrendous if it did, because it'd be very easy to treat. Much easier to deal with than a virus would be, as we know.
Well, thank you very much for your time. An excellent expert guide to the Black Death. So, Professor John Hatcher, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Professor John Hatcher. His book, The Black Death, A Personal History, is available now from Weidenfeld and Nicholson. You can find a link to purchase it in the description of this podcast. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy another episode from our back catalogue, where David Musgrove talked to Professor Jane Whittle about how the Black Death shaped England's economy and society. You can find that, along with articles about the key facts of the Black Death, on our website at historyextra.com. Just go to the search bar and type in Black Death. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Ewart and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow when Jeremy Krang will be speaking about the Blitz.